But what do we mean by the Mahayana? This may be a word which is quite new to some of you. And what is a Mahayana Sutra? And more important still, perhaps, what exactly do we mean by the inconceivable emancipation? So before we actually take the plunge, just a few words of explanation will no doubt be in order, at least for some of you. The word Mahayana, which is an Indian word, a Sanskrit word, means simply the great way or the great vehicle. And it's that form of Buddhism. It represents, it covers that form of Buddhism which sets no limit whatever to the spiritual potential of the individual. It's that form of Buddhism which encourages all living beings, without exception, to aim at the very highest conceivable goal of spiritual life. In other words, what we call supreme, perfect enlightenment. And one who aims at this supreme, perfect enlightenment, not for his own sake only, but for the sake, for the benefit of all, is known as a bodhisattva. In Mahayana Buddhism, therefore, all living beings, without exception, are encouraged to become bodhisattvas, to grow into bodhisattvas by the arising of what we call the bodhicitta, the thought of or will to supreme enlightenment for the benefit of all. All living beings are encouraged to take as bodhisattvas or would-be bodhisattvas the four great vows, which are, however innumerable beings are, I vow to deliver them. However inexhaustible the passions are, I vow to extinguish them. However immeasurable the teachings are, I vow to master them. However incomparable the Buddha truth is, I vow to attain it. These are certainly four magnificent, four awe-inspiring vows. But we have to understand that here it's not so much a question of the ordinary, limited self, as it were, taking these vows, as though it added these vows onto itself. Rather, it's a case of the ordinary self opening itself up to the forces of wisdom and compassion which these vows represent, and allowing wisdom and compassion to work through it, allowing itself to be inspired by them, by wisdom, by compassion. Now, sutra, the word sutra, means simply thread, especially in the sense of a thread of connection. And in a specifically Buddhist context, sutra is the name of a particular type, a particular kind of Buddhist canonical text. In fact, sutra is the type par excellence of Buddhist canonical text. When we speak of the sutras, just like that, we usually mean the Buddhist canonical text. We usually mean what we might call in the West the Buddhist scriptures. Sutras usually deal with a number of different topics in a more or less connected fashion. So in English, sutra is generally rendered simply as scripture. In Chinese, in ancient and classical Chinese, sutra was usually rendered as jing, which meant, as we usually translate that term, classic. But both these terms, that is to say the term scripture and the term classic, as representing the Chinese jing, both these renderings are a little misleading, because they both suggest that the sutras are primarily literary documents. After all, scripture means something actually written. But this is in fact not so. The sutras are not primarily literary documents, they are literary records of oral traditions. Traditions which originally were oral. It's very well known, I think, that the Buddha himself wrote nothing. He went about northeastern India. He met people. He spoke to people. He taught them, as we say. He communicated with them. He communicated to them the Dharma. To a lesser extent, or to a greater extent, as much of it as they could bear, as much of it as they could assimilate. But he did all this orally. He didn't do it by means of the written word. He did it entirely by means of the spoken word. He communicated orally, face to face, directly. And his disciples remembered, those who came in contact with him, remembered what he had said. Sometimes it made a tremendous impression upon them. Sometimes it represented a turning point in their lives. So how should they forget it? How should they not remember it? It was burned, as it were, into their hearts, into their minds, into their being. So they remembered. They became one with what he had said because they put it into practice. And they not only put it into practice, in due course they themselves attracted other people, attracted, as we say, disciples, and they taught their disciples. They communicated orally what they had heard from the Buddha of the Dharma, and they, their disciples, taught their disciples. And in this way, the teachings, the whole of the Buddha's Dharma, were handed down orally, in fact, for several centuries in India. And eventually, after 3, 4, 5 centuries, they were committed to writing. Not all at once, bit by bit. And in their written form, these oral traditions constitute the Buddhist canonical texts, the Buddhist canonical literature. These Buddhist scriptures, as we call them in English, it's important to understand, are not a Bible in the Christian sense. They're not some infallible revelation from God. They're the written record based on an oral tradition of the life and teaching of a supremely and perfectly enlightened human being. A human being who was the embodiment, the living embodiment of absolute wisdom and infinite compassion. So we can now see what a Mahayana Sutra is. Broadly speaking, a Mahayana Sutra is a canonical text in which the Buddha is represented as teaching, directly or indirectly, the Bodhisattva ideal. That is to say, the ideal of supreme perfect enlightenment for the benefit of all living beings. There are many, many Mahayana sutras in existence. Among them we have the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, including the very well-known Diamond Sutra and the equally well-known Heart Sutra. We have the White Lotus Sutra. We have the Sutra of Golden Light, and so on and so on. There are hundreds, perhaps thousands, of sutras. Some Mahayana sutras are still extant in the original Sanskrit in which the oral traditions were written down. But other Mahayana sutras are known to us only through ancient Chinese and ancient Tibetan translations.